morning.
Good to see you. Matthew 5, 13 through 20. What was just read for us is our text, so I encourage you to have your Bibles open to that spot. You know, when Jesus teaches us to be things that are very challenging for us, I really appreciate it that he gives us really good reasons for doing that, for being those things. In the section that we were reading about and studying about last week, with the first part of Matthew 5, there are some hard things in there, aren't there? Blessed are those who mourn. Blessed are those who are hungry and thirsty. Blessed are those who are persecuted for the sake of Jesus, for the sake of righteousness, for the sake of the kingdom. Well, why would we want to do that? Why would we want to be that? Well, partly, he says in that section, you're blessed and you're going to be that for my name because there is an eternal reward that you are storing up for yourself that you are going to inherit someday. You partially inherit it now with the blessings that you've got in Christ, but that will fully come to you at the end of days. So it's legitimate to serve Jesus for a reward. He promises that to us. But not only that, in this section that comes right after the Beatitudes, what Jesus is saying is, you're going to be blessed because you get to be my instruments to change the world. You get to be a city on a hill shining out for everybody to see. You get to be the salt in the meat, in the food, around you to other people. That's why we can go through everything that we go through with joy. Like he tells us to do there in verse 12, like we read about last week, rejoice and be glad. This is a part of why we can rejoice and be glad in Jesus Christ, even though we're not always going to feel good being his disciples. If we are salt and light, we have accepted his invitation to be the unhidden, undiluted ones that the world is looking for so that they can find him. That's the whole point of why we're here. So we're going to unpack that this morning, and we're going to start with his first image there in verse 13 of when he says, not you should be or you will hopefully become, but you are the salt of the world, the earth. I think this is interesting. What I think we need to do as we get into this image is talk about what this would mean to them as they heard Jesus' words. When we think about salt, we immediately think about the shakers on our kitchen tables, and that's legitimate, and that's partially what they use salt for, but they use salt for a whole bunch of interesting things, and I'll just list some of them. I won't list everything up here, but just a couple of things to mention here is, in the old law of Moses, it's interesting, you see salt coming up as a part of what they would use to worship God. They used it in their sacrifices, and they also used it in the incense that they created and then burned to God as part of their worship. You see this in Leviticus 2, 13. You shall season all of your grain offerings with salt. You shall not let the salt of the covenant with your God be missing from your grain offering. With all your offerings, you shall offer salt. Interesting, the salt of the covenant. Salt was such a valuable commodity in the ancient world. You know, kind of like the way people might fight over diamond mines today in Africa. People would fight over salt mines in the ancient world. It was like water. It was extremely valuable if you had it. And especially in hot climates in the Middle East where you sweat a lot. You need salt to replenish nutrients in your body. You need salt for all kinds of things to help it work. So the salt of the covenant. Covenants were often made with salt. People exchanging that. And so you put salt in your worship to God. Exodus 30, 35 also mentions, you shall make an incense blended as by the perfumer, seasoned with salt, pure and holy. So it was something that they used to offer to God. And yes, like we do today, even from very, very, very ancient times, the time of Job is essentially the time of Abraham. That's how far back we're talking. Even Job mentions this in kind of an offhanded way to talk about making food taste better. In verse 6 of chapter 6 of Job, "Can that which is tasteless be eaten without salt?" And in that context, he's talking about the worthless words of his friends, who are supposedly really good and helpful people, who come to him and say terrible, rotten, yucky things that don't taste good at all to him. He doesn't appreciate that. And so he's using that to talk about what they're doing. And then also, I don't have a scripture reference for this, but it was really, really common in this time and prior to this time to use salt as a way to preserve meat, especially, because you don't have you know, as helpful as refrigerators are and kind of essential to our lives in 21st century America, you know, refrigerators have not been around for very long. You know, it's kind of hard to think about that for us in our culture, but this is what you used. And in fact, I don't know how to really say that word. It's something like terakea. I'm going to pretend that that's the way that it is pronounced and just going to say it boldly. And terakea. Well, there's a town on the coast of Galilee called that, which literally meant salted fish. You know, that's a fishing industry around there. And so that they were, the people around Galilee were really, really familiar with using salt in this kind of way. And so when he says, "You are the salt of the earth," you know, they've got all kinds of coat hooks that they can hang that thought on when they hear this sermon that Jesus says. But I want you to notice what Jesus is saying here as he uses this in the sermon in Matthew 5. I think he's teaching this, that you are on the earth, you are amongst people who are decomposing because of their sin, who are tasteless, who are wanting so much more than they already have. You're on earth in order to help change that through direct contact. Now, what's interesting is, go back to verse 1 of chapter 5. Remember who Jesus is talking to? There's these massive crowds that have been following him, but verse 1 especially says, when he sat down, his disciples came to him. So his sermon, while I'm sure that there are some hangers-on who are just kind of there for the show, I mean, he is directly talking to the people who have already signed up for his cause, his disciples, his committed followers, who've got all kinds of problems themselves, but they have said, "Yeah, we're following you, Jesus." So he's talking to them. When he says "you," evidently that "you" in verse 13 is really emphatic in the Greek. You are the salt of the earth. Verse 14, you are the light of the world. And so he's stressing that his disciples are God's instruments for affecting the world. You are a preservative, he's saying to us and to them. The presence of Christians in any culture is holding back the decay of sin in the world. That is a really interesting thought. And kind of almost holding back God's judgment on a city or a culture. Have you ever thought about that in connection with Sodom and Gomorrah? In fact, Ty, on Wednesday night, Ty brought up the Genesis passage where God is talking about what he's going to do with Sodom and Gomorrah. He's talking to Abraham. And do you remember how he got down to 10 people? If 10 people are in Sodom, then I'm not going to come and destroy it. Now, he did, because there weren't 10 people in Sodom who cared about him. But if there had been, then that would have stayed God's hand. How many people does the United States of America have who are righteous in order for God to stay his hand of judgment on our culture? I don't know the answer to that. There's no way to know the answer to that. But it's an interesting thought to think that if you and I, in our little individual lives, if we care about Jesus Christ and we teach the next generation to care about Jesus Christ as well, then what that is doing is that is contributing to this effort of God to put people in places to hold back the decay of sin. You are God's flavor in the world. You are a part of the worship that is offered to Him right here, right now, in the presence of the citizens of Rantoul. Here we are. Everybody can drive past on 136, drive past on this road, and see our cars here, can see us, and be a part of this. And I'm not just saying that this is all that this is talking about, but this is one example of what we're doing here. So whatever picture you want to attach to the salt image here, all of these meanings have this in common, that salt works through direct contact with the food that it gets on. I think what's neat about salt is that a little bit goes a really long way, doesn't it? So this afternoon, when you get your lunch, and you think, you know what? It needs some salt. It needs some flavor. It only takes a couple of shakes of your salt shaker in order to make that work. Maybe even one, depending on how much salt is coming out. And the thing is, you can look down on your plate after you've done that, and you can't physically, usually, see the salt flecks on your food. But then you take a bite, and your taste buds go, whoa, hello, salt. There you are. Because a little bit, just a little bit, goes a really long way. This reminds me so much of what happens to George Bailey in the movie It's a Wonderful Life. You remember how he gets to a point in that film where he is so discouraged about what is going on with him and his family that he basically reaches a point where he says, everybody would have been better off had I just not even been here to begin with. And through the whole course of the rest of the movie, he figures out that actually, no, Bedford Falls, even the name of Bedford Falls, would have been different had I not been alive. Don't ever forget that your little life, as brief as it is, as small as it is in the grand picture of the billions and billions of people who have ever lived on planet Earth and are living here now, as small as your life is, it matters tremendously. More than you can imagine, that there are people looking at you who you had no idea they're looking at you and watching your life and hearing your words and viewing your example, and your influence is going out into the world. And we need to remember to make sure that it goes out to the extent that it should. Salt should contact the thing that it wants to influence. Because what Jesus is teaching here is also a warning. Did you notice that in the passage? If salt loses its saltiness, its taste, verse 13, how shall its saltiness be restored? It's no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled under people's feet. How does salt actually lose its saltiness? Can that actually happen? You know, have you ever salted your food and the salt just decided one day that it just didn't want to work and so you know, had to figure out some other spice? No, it doesn't usually work that way. I'm definitely not a chemist. I am not a scientist at all. But I've been told by people who know chemistry really well that sodium chloride is a really stable compound. You know, it is what it is. It's not going to lose its saltiness all by itself. But at this time of history, remember, you can't go to the grocery store and just pick up a package of salt. What you have to do is you have to go down to the Dead Sea, where there's a lot of salt down there, and you have to, you know, break off the chunks, or you have to go to a salt marsh and you have to pick up some big lumps of yuckiness that has some salt kind of in there, and then you have to refine it. But if you, for whatever reason, if that lump that you've got, if the salt kind of leaches out of that lump, then you've just got a whole bunch of impurities, and you've got a nasty residue that is so diluted it's completely worthless. And Jesus says at the end of 13, what use is it? What can you use it for? Well, you can't use it for anything except throw it out on the road for people to stomp on as they're walking past your house. We become useless like that if we are deluded by the world that we live in. And this could be applied in so many concrete ways. In the summer months, when everybody's taking off their clothes, Christians should not be doing that. When people go out to a public dance floor on a Friday night or whenever they do that, and they bust some really sensual moves with their partner, Christians should not be doing that. When everybody else in the world is looking to consume physical substances that change the way that my body feels so that I can escape from whatever's going on in my life, or I can try to find some comfort in that, Christians should not be doing that. I mean, there's so many different things that we could think about this applies to, including the way that we talk. And this is something that Colossians directly brings out. And I don't know if Paul had the Sermon on the Mount in his mind when the Holy Spirit inspired him to write Colossians 4. But this is something that he connects this to. That let the words coming out of your mouth always be gracious, seasoned with salt, so that you may know how you ought to answer each person. And in that context, he is talking about the way that you interact with outsiders, walking with wisdom in that, and making sure that you are speaking in a way to them that displays Christ in you, so that they can follow that as well. I don't think any of us get out of this verse unscathed, right? I don't know how this time and place compares to all the other times and places, but we live in a time and in a place where people just can't talk to each other, where disagreement is just automatically taken as hatred. That if you don't appreciate what I just said, then that must mean that you don't appreciate me, period. And talking past each other is just so common. People are yelling and screaming at each other online and in person, and Christians are doing it too. I think if we're being honest with ourselves, we could probably all trot out examples in our own lives of when our speech was not as gracious and as seasoned as it could have been. I definitely can for myself. In fact, just this last week, my speech was not like this at all. And I think the root cause of that, of when it's not seasoned, is not the craziness that's happening in culture. Because there will always be crazy things that happen in culture. That's true of the Roman Empire. That's going to be true of our culture too. So it's not COVID. It's not ICE. It's not whatever politician you may or may not appreciate that you can link up to and say, that's why I am the way that I am. That's why my neighbors. The root, the absolute root cause of lack of gracious speech is unsubmission to the kingdom of Jesus Christ. And if we were salted by the gospel, then our speech would be salted, regardless of the time and place that we live in. So this is a powerful point to think about here, as is what he says right after this. The second big illustration that he gives of you are not just salt, but you are the light of the world. This is, I'll just throw both of those up there. Light, when you look at it, and we spent a whole year in our class period recently, you know, talking about light and what it is in the Bible, and we saw how in the very beginning in Genesis, that is the first thing that God makes. Which is interesting because Timothy says that God dwells in unapproachable light. And so the very first thing he makes before galaxies and before guppies and before dolphins and before everything else and us, trees, flowers, bushes, he makes light as a way of saying, I'm going to put part of where myself, where I live, in your domain. And that's my plan for you all, to both receive that and then to give that to other people, because that's what God does. He has light and he gives it. And that's his plan for us. And that's his plan for the recreation as well. In John 1, that's the continual picture of Jesus, that the light was not overcome by the darkness. The light came into the world in the person of Jesus. And so when he says, you are now the light of the world, think about, in the Jewish mind, what that would mean. It would mean Genesis, but also it would mean these wonderful prophecies like what we see in Isaiah, and when we were in the light year, the year on light. We covered some of these, but what I want you to do is just drink from the fire hose for a little bit with me. I'm going to flash some of these up on the screen. I want you to think about being a Jew and hearing these at the time that Isaiah prophesied these things, and then being at the site of the Sermon on the Mount and listening to Jesus say, you are the light of the world, and having these in the back of your mind. So we covered this one recently because this is one that Matthew himself uses just before this there in chapter 4. But again, here it is again, chapter 9 of Isaiah, there will be no more gloom for her who was in anguish. In the former time, he brought into contempt the land of Zebulun, the land of Naphtali, but in the latter time, he's made glorious the way of the sea, the land beyond the Jordan, Galilee of the nations. The people who walked in darkness have seen a great light. Those who dwelt in a land of deep darkness, on them has light shone. Isaiah 42, 1 through 6, I am the Lord, I have called you in righteousness. I will take you by the hand and keep you. This is like father and son kind of language here. I will give you, as a covenant for the people, a light for the nations. In verse 16 of that same chapter, I will lead the blind in a way that they do not know. In paths that they have not known, I will guide them. I will turn the darkness before them into light, the rough places into level ground. These are the things I do, and I do not forsake them. Again, this has the finality of when Jesus says the kingdom of heaven is at hand. It is. It's here. It's coming. There's no ifs about it. In Isaiah 58, 6 through 11, he says this, is not this the fast that I choose? To loose the bonds of wickedness, to undo the straps of the yoke, to let the oppressed go free and to break every yoke? Is it not to share bread with the hungry, to bring the homeless poor into your house? When you see the naked, to cover him and not to hide yourself from your own flesh, then shall your light break forth like the dawn, and your healing shall spring up speedily. Your righteousness shall go before you. The glory of the Lord shall be your rear guard. Then you shall call, and the Lord will answer. You shall cry, and he will say, here I am. If you take away the yoke from your midst, The pointing of the finger and speaking wickedness. If you pour yourself out for the hungry and satisfy the desire of the afflicted, then shall your light rise in the darkness and your gloom be as the noonday. Do you see how when Jesus later on in Matthew is going to talk about two different pictures of some people who put clothes on people that they found who didn't have clothes and gave food to people who didn't have food and visited some in prison who needed somebody to visit them? When that happens there in Matthew, that is directly based on what the prophets have already said. If you do these things, then your light shines, your light comes. It's powerful stuff. Isaiah 60, verse 1, and 19 through 20. Arise, shine, awake, O sleeper. Arise from the dead, and Christ will shine on you. Where do you think Paul got that from? Your light has come. The glory of the Lord has risen upon you. For behold, darkness shall cover the earth, and thick darkness the peoples. But the Lord will arise upon you, and His glory will be seen upon you. And nations shall come to your light, and kings to the brightness of your rising. The sun, 19 and 20, shall be no more your light by day, nor for brightness shall the moon give you light, but the Lord will be your everlasting light, and your God will be your glory. Where did John get this image in Revelation? Here it is. Your sun shall no more go down, nor your moon withdraw itself, for the Lord will be your everlasting light, and your days of mourning shall be ended. So when Jesus gets up and he tells his disciples, you are the light of the world. Do you see everything that would have been attached to that phrase? This is God's long-standing plan for his people. And so he's bringing this up to say, if we, in an unashamed kind of way, live our lives before the one who has saved us for his cause, for his glory, then he will make sure that we are noticed by his people, by other people and his people, for his glory and not for our own. It's interesting that both of the metaphors that Jesus uses, the city on a hill and the light that shouldn't be hidden under a basket, both of those mean it should be obvious to everybody around you who we are. We're meant to be seen. By the way, the city on a hill image there actually was a city perched up, built up on a hill on the other side of the Galilee Lake from where Jesus preached the sermon. And so every night, the people of Capernaum, the town was called Hippos. Horse, basically. It kind of looked like a horse's head up there on the hill. The people of Capernaum could go out of their homes every night and they could look out across the lake and they could see this city all lit up. It was a Roman city. Weren't a lot of Jews living there. And they could see that's the influence of the empire ruling over us. And Jesus, I think, maybe looked across the lake and maybe he pointed over there and he said, you guys be like that. That Roman city over there, you guys be like that for me, for my cause. Christians should not just be nice people. There are plenty of nice people in the world. Lots of nice people. But it's Christians, it's Christ followers who actually have something to give to the world that's dark. He wants our lives to stick out from the crowd. And this is where I think the sermon gets a little bit tricky, because if you keep reading in Matthew, doesn't he say in chapter 6, verse 1, don't practice your righteousness in order to be seen by others? Doesn't he say there in verse 2, give to the needy, but don't show everybody what you're doing? Verse 5, you know, don't pray on the street corners where everybody's going to see you pray. You know, go to a private place and do that. Verse 16, don't fast and not wash your face, because that's what the hypocrites do. They want people to see, oh man, he's been afflicting himself. He must be really, really holy. That's not what we're supposed to be about. So how do we pull these threads together? Well, good works have to be a part of our regular lives. Ephesians 2:10, we were created to walk in the good works that God has prepared for us beforehand. We're supposed to be doing good things all the time, wherever we are, but not intentionally to get people to notice us. But if we go about our normal business, God will take care of making sure that people get wind of what we're doing so that he can be glorified. I think that's what verse 16 is talking about in our text. In the same way, let your light shine before others so that they may see your good works and give glory to your Father who is in heaven. Our job is not to go around posting on Facebook every time we go and help somebody, as I sometimes see people doing. Our job is not to hide who we are, but our job is to be quiet about that and allow God to do the work of showing what we're doing so that people can see him. This little light of mine, I'm going to let it shine, as we sometimes sing with our kids. And then we get into 17 through 20, where Jesus will clarify what he's doing in his ministry work, what he's doing in this sermon, because he is about to blow the doors off of the hypocrites in the rest of even just chapter 6, as he exposes, this is what you've heard, this is the way people apply the law, and that is totally off base. That is not what God's intention was. And so what he's doing is, I'm just going to throw them both up. He's deconstructing and he is also reconstructing at the same time in this part where he says, on the one hand, what I'm doing is I'm taking people back to the original purpose that God had in the law, which was to teach love. It's interesting that one of the main gripes that people seem to have with Christians is, you guys just hate the law of Moses. You guys just hate Moses. You remember in Acts chapter 6, when Stephen is getting falsely accused, one of the things that they said about him was, he's speaking things about this place, the temple, and the law. I'm sure he was teaching the law has, that covenant has now been set aside. We now have a new covenant. But Stephen wasn't anti-law, anti-prophets, and Jesus wasn't either. He didn't come to abolish them. He didn't come to burn them. You know, we still got these things in our Bibles today for really good reasons. He came to fulfill all of the Old Testament. He used the law and the prophets to say, here's who I am. Psalm 22. My God, why have you forsaken me? Isaiah 53. You know, this is what shows who Jesus is. It all point forward to him. And that's why Paul encouraged Timothy to keep studying the scriptures that he had. What did Timothy have? I don't think he had the complete, you know, collected edition of the New Testament. He had Genesis through Malachi. But that is all good for equipping the man of God to do the good works that God has called us to do. And so if you were a local church in Bithynia, and you didn't have Romans, and you didn't have 1 Peter, and you didn't have the Gospel of Matthew for a while, you had the Old Testament. And that's what you would encourage people with on Sundays. And that's what you would teach your neighbor on Wednesdays. Because what the law kept coming back to was, number one, love the Lord your God with everything you've got. And then number two, the second greatest commandment, Jesus points out in Leviticus 19, you love your neighbor. not just the person who is living in the house next to you, but whatever human you run across who is hungry and destitute and in prison and sick and lonely and in desperate need of help. You love that person. You pour yourself out for that person, like Isaiah was talking about. So he is, what Jesus is doing, he's reconstructing that here, but he's also tearing something else down. He's tearing down false righteousness. A people who claim to look like God and act like God and talk like God, but actually are far from his heart because they're selectively serving him. They're picking and choosing. In verse 19, notice that again. Therefore, whoever relaxes one of the least of these commandments and teaches others to do the same will be called least in the kingdom of heaven. But whoever does them and teaches them will be called great in the kingdom of heaven. For I tell you, unless your righteousness exceeds that of the scribes and the Pharisees, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. Pharisees did what Jesus says in verse 19. They would say, okay, we really got to be careful about counting our seeds and tithing. But when it comes to taking care of your parents, I mean, you can give some money to the temple and you can call it a day. You don't really have to do much with that. And Jesus never said to the Pharisees, counting seeds, you don't have to do that. No, that's part of the law. It's not one of the weightier matters. It's one of the things that you should do. But you should also make sure that you're doing the other things that you guys seem to dismiss. We cannot get rid of anything that God has said. We cannot overlook it. We cannot pass over it as if it's not important. Whatever he has told us to do, regardless of whether it fits our emphasis, if it's our preferences, it's what we need to teach, it's what we need to believe, it's what we need to do. And Jesus says, if you back off of anything that God has said, that's not a sign of spiritual maturity, that's a sign of spiritual weakness, in fact. The Pharisees didn't have the right to pick and choose, and we don't either. But have we thought about how that applies? You know, I'd imagine that there'd be probably a lot of people in here who would start falling out of pews if I got up and I said, you know, it'd be good if we rolled a piano in here. It'd be good if, you know, somebody got up with a guitar. I think Byron says he plays the guitar. If Byron got up here and did a guitar solo one day as we're worshiping God, I think people, you know, we'd all start, you know, having conniptions. And I don't think that's something that we should do, but would we have the same kind of feelings of, oh, if I got up here and I said, you know, forgiveness is just, it's just not something that we really need to go as far as Jesus says here. You know, when you get really frustrated with somebody and they don't come and apologize to you, you can hold on to some of those things until they come and make that right with you. You know, that is not what Jesus teaches here, but there could be ways in which we pass over some of the radical things he has said that hit us in places where we don't really want to be hit. What Jesus is saying here in this passage on salt and light and in the purpose that he's come to give us is that we need to be all in. We just sang a song that Toby led about being true-hearted and whole-hearted and faithful to Jesus. And that fits really well. I didn't talk to Toby about that, but that fits really well with this point that Jesus is trying to help us see here. We're invited to a life that is undiluted from the world and not hidden from the people who need this message. And so this is a challenging question that he's leaving us with is, are you going to live this? Are you going to take this cause and run with it? I think verse 20 would have absolutely have shocked the people who heard Jesus that day, because the Pharisees, if anybody looked righteous, the Pharisees did. And so I'm sure that his people thought, well, how can I be more righteous than them? Well, it's by loving the Lord with all of your heart. It's by letting him come into every aspect of your life and not just some of them, not just resting in some carefully defined doctrines over here and being comfortable with preaching those and teaching those, and yet laying aside some other things that Jesus has taught over here that maybe don't fit my mantra at the time or the culture that I live in. Whatever he says, that's what we need to believe. Are you doing that? If you're not, part of the purpose of this assembly is to be supportive of you as you come closer to Jesus Christ yourself. We are not supposed to be a collection of disjointed individuals. God's intention for a local church is for us to be a support. And so if this message hits you today, if you've been thinking about your life and you need help, please let us know how we can help you this morning. As we stand up, we sing the song Toby selected.